I'm skiing through the woods with my hands behind my back, and I caught my left edge and I hit a tree. I disappear over the edge, slide down in the river, lay there 2 hours, and the cold water running over my neck prevented my spinal cord from rupturing. And that's why I'm walking today. And ended up in a coma for a week.
It got to the point where you were ready to die. You had like made plans to leave.
I had made arrangements, yep. Dead my life, yep.
Because the pain was so brutal.
I'm in constant pain all the time. I sleep 1 hour a night. Half the night I'm screaming in pain in my room by myself. My wife doesn't even sleep with me. She sleeps in another room. The fact that I'm here and sitting in front of you and we're able to converse and talk about important things and help people is a credit to my belief system and my belief in all of you as part of that belief system.
That moment of near disaster.
And with difficulty kept my course.
Of chimpanzees in the wild.
It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Mark, it's so good to see you again. It's we got to talk a little bit last time, and I was so blown away by your story that I was instantly telling my colleagues that I gotta interview you for a podcast.
Well, it's great to be here, Albert. Thanks for the invite.
We've had kind of similar journeys in some way. I think yours a lot more intense than mine. In fact, you got right to the very edge. But I just wanted to maybe start with you giving a recap of how we got to know each other and what, you know, what the context of all this is in terms of your journey and all that.
You reached out. Was it you reached out or I reached out to you? I cannot remember. But somehow it got on my schedule. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember for sure. I was giving a talk somewhere about my whole journey with phantom limb pain and letting go of pain through neuroplasticity. And then somebody got on my radar and said, you know, you really need to talk to Mark. Mark is somebody who had this profound experience, but also comes from a place of a very unique perspective, having run these major healthcare sort of vehicles throughout your life, right? So, can you just give a little background as to your history in healthcare?
So you reached out to me, and then we connected and had this fantastic conversation. I'll never forget it. You know, I worked on the streets of Detroit as a paramedic in the late 70s. You know, AIDS epidemic was coming and all sorts of crazy stuff. And then I worked in a level one trauma center in Detroit. I was the department coordinator for 4 years because the streets were a little too intense for me. So I went inside into an emergency room, ran that. And as I saw sort of the crazy part of the healthcare system, right? The emergency rooms are where everybody sort of falls to when there's no other access. I realized the system was pretty badly broken. I had been anticipating to become a medical student and clearly decided after about 6 years of doing that work that that was not where I wanted to end up. And so I had this very sort of, I want to call it somewhat jaundiced view of how the healthcare system worked and decided to work. I came out of graduate school. I got lucky enough to get into Cornell as a underprivileged student, and I got into Cornell and I went to got my MBA there in finance. And as I was looking at jobs in trading and in banking, a buddy of mine reached out to me and said, "We're starting an HMO. Do you want to start one?" And I said, "What the heck's an HMO?" And he sent me the red herring from U.S. Healthcare Public Offering in 81. And I said, "Oh, this looks pretty cool." And so I went back to Detroit, where I grew up. My wife and I went back, and we started the company and lost all our money in the first 3 years. We ran out of money, $12 million. We had to struggle to put it back together. But, you know, we shrunk the organization, resized it, got it ready. And it was my first turnaround. We turned it into a company that ultimately got purchased by a group of hospital corporations as a, you know, physician hospital organization, a predecessor to something that had never been done before. And I went on my merry way.
This is not a small company. This is a company that I think a lot of people would know, right?
My first company was SelectCare in Detroit. I went to New York Life. They reached out to me and said they had a group asset, so they wanted to fix that. And so I went to work there. They had an HMO. They had a drug PBM company called Express Scripts that we took public in 93, 94. It's one of the largest PBMs today. And then we created NowCare Health Plan, sold that to Aetna for $1.8 billion in 1997. And I retired again, and I was home for a while. And I was at that time in 97, I was 41 years old, and Cigna reached out. And while I was at Cigna, and I'd been there about maybe a year, my son got incredibly ill with a very rare cancer. Only 34 people had ever been diagnosed with it. And Eric's cancer was T-cell gamma delta lymphoma, and everybody who'd ever had it before were dead. And so they told me he had 6 months, take him home, enjoy his company. I instead, and my wife and I went looking for advice, and we found a doctor in Boston, Ava Guinan, who is an amazing hematologist and researcher. And she said, you know, this is a deadly disease. You couldn't have drawn a worse card. But there's something I've always wanted to try. I just never seen this case. And it was to do a bad bone marrow transplant, create graft versus host disease, which would kill the T cells that are cancerous. And if you could survive the graft versus host disease, he'd live. Mm. So I literally quit my job and moved into his hospital room with him and lived there with him. And met with the medical team every morning for an hour. I mean, it was 16.
He must have been 16. What a thing. I could not imagine.
I was devastated.
On a father.
In Harrison's internal medicine text with little yellow stickies in it on all the pages that mattered. I still have it actually downstairs here in my house in the library. Every once in a while I pull it out and say, this is the book that, you know, helped save my son's life. I had a laptop and would talk to NIH doctors at the NIH website all the time. They had, you know, chat rooms back then. This is 2002. And 2003 was the transition time frame. We got rid of his cancer, but his graft versus host disease was horrifying. And he was bleeding his total body volume of blood every day for months. And we finally put him into hospice on July 15th, 2002. I had been using all the traditional books.
I mean, not only have you been using all the traditional methods, but you come from, at that point, I mean, you've already sold multiple healthcare companies for billions of dollars. You're in a position, both financially and also from the perspective of all your network, to tap into the very best of modern Western science.
Yep.
And your son's on the line.
And so he was allergic to soy, and they were trying to use intralipids to help bring his albumin back up. He was starving, was what was happening. And so I'm looking on this website, and it talks about the use of Premarin, conjugated estrogen and ureter bleeds, in kidney transplants. And so I go to the team, and I go, kidney, it's not an organ transplant, but it's still a transplant. And the ureter and the gut are the same stuff, same material pretty much. Let's try 25 milligrams of Premarin for the next 4 or 5 days. And his bleeding stopped. But yet he still couldn't eat. We couldn't give him the intralipids in the United States. So I went to one doctor and I said, and I used to meet with the team. I used to bring my book. And I walked in without the book. And they said, where's your book? I said, it's useless. We're in territory nobody's ever been before. My son's starving. We've got his bleeding stopped. He needs to get intralipids. Surely there has to be an intralipid somewhere in the world that's other than a soy-based intralipid. And one of the residents said, you know what? I took nutrition at Hopkins as a medical student. I'll call my professor. And sure enough, in Austria was a drug called OmegaVen. It was made with omega-3 fatty acids. And I got, but it wasn't FDA approved. So I went down to the FDA, met with this lady and said, my son's dying. I need your help. How do I get this drug approved? She goes, well, there's these three pages. They're called single patient compassionate use exception. Fill them out. Have your doctors call our doctors. And if it makes sense, we'll do it. And so a few days later, we got it approved. The drug got sent from Austria to Children's Hospital in Boston. And in February of 2003, he came home.
Wow. What a thing. Just you found the key. You unlocked some kind of mystery key that was in uncharted territory, and it saved your son's life.
Yep. The interesting thing is the Omega Van, there are lots of other horror stories in it. You know, they used to run out of blood at the blood bank. I used to give my blood so they could give it to him because we're the same blood type, you know, all that sort of stuff. The interesting thing was that they thought I was being too aggressive as a parent. And they actually had considered taking him away from me as an emancipated minor. I was halfway home to Hartford to sit with my daughter, and I spun the car around on 90 and drove 100 miles an hour hoping to catch a cop. Never caught one, of course. Got back to the Boston, walked into the room. They're all in there, and I threw them all out. I said, I am the adult in the room. He's a minor. All of you out of here now. And I grabbed the attending physician. I said, he will continue his treatment. And so he ultimately came home. And a year to the day of him coming home, February 18th, 2003, he came home. February 18th, 2004, I was skiing off piste. And I hit a tree and I broke my neck in five places. And I fell backwards onto a slope and I slid 60 feet down into a river and I laid in the cold river for 2 hours until they found me to get and got me out. And the cold water running over my neck prevented my spinal cord from rupturing. And that's why I'm walking today and I'm not a quadriplegic.
Well, that's this is actually the next part of the story, which really I think is why I wanted to share your story a bit because of the context of it. You know, okay, so the story of your son, that's a huge one. And as a father myself, I can only imagine what it would be like to be in that position, to have to fight and advocate for somebody in every single way, to break every rule. In fact, I've done this before. I've had to be the advocate for somebody before in their cancer journey. And fortunately it didn't go out the way we wanted it to go. But when you find that key, all of a sudden there's hope. And before that, it's like a darkness, right? And I'm so incredibly blown away by that journey that you had with your son.
I was locked and loaded. I was so focused. The emotion went away. Right. And I remember the doctor walking in one day and goes, Mr. Bertolini, we've been talking about a do not resuscitate for your son. Would you sign one? I said, no, I'm here all the time. I'll make the call when the moment comes, but no. And he goes, you know, I don't want to rely on you as a non-physician to make those calls. I want to make that call. So I grabbed him by the back of his lab coat, walked him outside the room, pushed his face up against the Bill of Rights in the hall and said, my son's a minor and I'm the patient and we'll do it my way.
Nobody's going to tell you what to do. It's your son's life on the line. How can they, you know, like how can somebody try to get in the middle of you and your son when the decisions are.
Their problem was, is that he was a kid with a very bad disease that nobody had ever survived. They already wrote him off. And he went in there with 15 other patients, all of whom died, and he was the only one that left the bone marrow transplant unit. And that's they didn't see him when he was riding his bike when he's a kid. They didn't see him skiing on the slopes with me. They didn't see him on all those pieces of his life where I knew he was a human being. Right?
Yeah, the physicians had given up. They had created a narrative that they were then letting unfold as they saw it in their textbooks. And yet you were saying, hey, there's a frontier here that matters because this is someone's story. This is actually a person, not just a stat.
Yep.
But then you became the person.
I became the person. Eric today is a theoretical physicist. He was working at State Street Global Advisors in their quant shop. He was one of their top quant guys. And one day he goes to school one day. At his kid's school, he's married to a Chinese American, so both his kids are Asian. Went to the school talking to the teachers, and they said, we don't have enough math teachers in our high school. So he quit his job, and he's now teaching high school math in the Dover Public Schools in New Hampshire.
Oh, what an incredible kid. I mean, now man who's giving up, you know, giving back to so much. But I wanted to get to the part where it actually then becomes a little bit even more at the frontier. And that's when, you know, so now your background is you've been a health advocate for somebody. You've understood the power of finding that frontier and figuring out the scientific nuances of the unknown, saying, hey, look, it's not going to be in the textbook anymore. Those little sticky pads and everything like that, done. Let's find a solution. So you've seen this possible before. You also were at one point, I believe, the CEO of Aetna. Is that right?
Yep. At the time, I was an executive vice president of Aetna when Eric got out of the hospital.
I mean, not a lot of people can say that they were at that position or have been at that position in the healthcare industry. Can you explain to everybody what that would be? So Aetna, being one of the largest healthcare insurance providers in the country, you have a view of the healthcare system.
Not only the country, we were paying for healthcare in virtually every country in the world. We had an international division. So I used to travel 200 days a year. I just kept going west all the time.
In a way, if there was anybody who was ingrained into Western medicine and the frontiers of Western medicine more than you, I don't know who it could be, right? Like, you've had a personal experience with it. You are quickly becoming the chief executive officer of one of the largest institutions for providing healthcare, you know, funding and all that. You've sold billions of dollars worth of healthcare companies, and then you're down a slope. You're skiing through the powder.
I actually went off a rock into the woods, and I'm skiing through the woods with my hands behind my back. And I caught my left edge and I hit a tree. It hit me here. I was looking over my shoulder to see if my daughter was okay. I disappear over the edge, slide down in the river, lay there 2 hours, and ended up in a coma for a week. They found me, medevaced me out, took me to Dartmouth, because I was off piece in Killington, took me down to Dartmouth, where I was in the neuro ICU and you know, halo brace and all that sort of stuff. And they were, the helicopter crew that took me to the hospital were stunned when they find out I was still alive 2 weeks later. They actually came to see me because they couldn't believe it. My head was on my right shoulder. My breathing was labored, chain stoking. I was doing the death breathing when they medevaced me, but I had all this snow and ice around my neck that prevented my spinal cord from rupturing, saved my life.
You remember any of the thoughts that were there thoughts?
No, all I remember is looking back, seeing my daughter, and then I go black. And I think it was 7 days later, 6-7 days later, I wake up. A nurse is giving me a sponge bath. I go, what are you doing? And she goes, oh my God, he's awake. Because they were waiting for me to, you know, flatline. And so they, you know, oh my God, he's awake, goes running from the room. The doctor comes in and says to me, I'll never forget, it was, who was the group? 100 Years was on MTV. They know my kids knew I liked watching MTV, so they had MTV on the room the whole time, and it was like 100 Years. I can't remember the name of the song. When you've lived 100 years or something like that. So I wake up and the doctor says, what do you want to know? And I said, well, I obviously had a skiing accident because that's the last thing I remember doing. He goes, do you have any questions? I said, yeah. How do I get out of here? Because if you keep me here, you'll kill me. And he said, well, we've got to have you walking. And you got to be able to go up and down stairs because your home has stairs to get you up to your room. I said, okay, well, let's do work on that. 5 days later, I signed out against medical advice and left the hospital.
You ran healthcare insurance companies your whole life, and yet you don't want to be in the hospital.
You'd never be in a hospital. I mean, they've done studies, and there is a very low percentage of clinicians who wash their hands before they touch you. And one of the biggest causes of death in hospitals is iatrogenic illness, illness created by infection by other providers. I mean, I've had a number of surgeries to try and fix my spine. And, you know, I had a doctor pull a chest tube out of me after an emergency surgery I had with bare hands on their way home. And I got an infection. So, you know, now I'm a pretty resilient. I seem to be able to absorb and destroy diseases pretty regularly. But it's, you know, it's a I have a good my neurosurgeon describes me after having opened me up and found a cloudy cerebral spinal fluid in my spinal column that I obviously must have a very high immunity capability because I seem to kill off things that that otherwise would kill other people. But in the end, you know, I wake up and I leave the hospital. And I start rehabbing at home and I had no pain. I had some neck pain, but I had no pain until about 3 weeks later when the nervous system started to kick back in and I had excruciating pain. I mean, it woke me up out of a sound sleep. I couldn't sleep. And that began a journey of 18 years of level 7 to 10 pain, 24/7, sleeping an hour a night pretty much for 18 years.
Okay, so for those of you out there who have never experienced chronic pain, it's very different than acute pain. Chronic pain, you know, where it's just never going to go away and it's always there. For me, when I had that for a period of time with my own body, it felt like I was drowning and your head is just below the surface and you just can't get that gasp of air for relief. It becomes so consuming. And then when it also starts taking away your sleep, then everything gets compounded. It's awful, right?
It's awful. And the right side of your brain shuts down after a while because, you know, you're dealing with all the trauma and the amygdala and the pain is destroying any sense of empathy that you have. And so my right side of my brain shut down, but the left side of my brain became a machine. I mean, I ran a multinational global corporation, you know, as CEO for 9 years. And, you know, it had outstanding performance over that time.
And which company and, was know, that? And,
Aetna.
You ran Aetna.
It was a Fortune 50 company.
How many of us out there have Aetna insurance? I don't know. What is the number now?
Yeah. What? Oh, it was 54 million had some form of Aetna insurance back when I was running it.
54 million. So you were helping trying to provide insurance coverage to 54 million people while you were on 7 out of 10 level chronic pain, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But I didn't take any narcotics.
With no painkillers.
Zero.
Yeah. Just taking it right on the chin.
I was on 7 different opioids for the first year. And if you ever seen the Charlie Brown cartoons when his mother talks to him, it goes, wah, 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 wah. That's how my whole world sounded. And I still had incredible pain. It didn't take the pain away. I just didn't care about it after a while. But that was no way to live. And I said, I've either got to get off these drugs or I got to get off the planet because I can't live this way. And so I went to – and I'd never been a proponent of alternative therapies. I always thought my son got Reiki while he was getting his bone marrow transplant. And the person who gave him Reiki said, would you like to try some? And I lasted 5 minutes and said, aren't you going to touch me? And she goes, no, it's all energy. I said, get away. I can't do this. It's craziness. You're making me crazy. Either touch me or go away.
Especially from your perspective, right? Like having been so ingrained in the infrastructure, in the global infrastructure of healthcare, it must have been a very specifically a very difficult thing looking from your perspective at alternative medicines in a wholly open way. And now you're there. Now you're in it. Now you're feeling this gasping air of desperation for some kind of relief. And what happens?
My wife comes home and says, you should try cranial sacral therapy. I said, what is it? So I look it up. They hold onto your head and they hold onto your sacrum and they manipulate the energy flow inside the dural sheath around your brain and spinal column because that's supposed to have a normal rhythm of the heartbeat. But I had so much damage up around my neck that it was swirling. And so I go get cranial sacral therapy, and I can't imagine how somebody holding onto my head and my butt for an hour is going to make a difference. But after four treatments, I actually started feeling better.
What do they do? It's just like a, it's a, how do they manipulate the energy? What
they manipulate with both hands on the back of the skull and just very light pressure, and then they go down to the sacrum and they hold the hand under the sacrum. What they try to do is get the cerebral spinal fluid to rock in a rhythm again, like it's supposed to. All of us have it's the second heartbeat in a human is the cerebral spinal fluid rhythm going up and down your spinal column, bathing your brain, bathing your spinal cord. And mine was stuck up here and it was spinning. And so I had all sorts of anxiety from it, which was exacerbating the pain. So I get cranial sacral therapy, 4 weeks, all of a sudden it's like, oh my God. And then after about 6 months, I'm off all my drugs. I'm not taking any more narcotics. I still have pain, but no worse than it was when I was on the drugs. And then this person that was teaching me, was doing cranial sacral therapy, said to me, why don't you try yoga? I said, oh my God, yoga's for girls. I don't do yoga. And she said, bet me. And so she put together a treatment, practicing with one arm, and had me, I was like broken to bits by the time the first lesson was over. And I thought, wow, this is killing me. And this is great. It feels so good to push my body and feel the feedback. And because I was an athlete, always a body aware kind of kid. And so I started doing yoga and I said, oh my, there's something more to this. And so I started looking at, you know, the origins of yoga. There was a great book by a guy named Leonard Perlmutter that ran the sort of, it was called The Heart and Science of Yoga. And it was about the, you know, how Western spirituality and Eastern spirituality could come together in yoga. And I was doing Vinny yoga. So, you know, the eight limbs of yoga, you know, yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, and then the four limbs of meditation. And it's all about getting the body to be able to sit for extended periods of time in meditation is what all the poses and breathing are. And I read the Upanishads, and then I read the Bhagavad Gita, and then the Pratavijna Hridayam. And all of a sudden I got it. I went, oh my God, this is amazing. Because while my son was in the hospital, the whole story on the Catholic Church broke in Boston in 2002. And I'm reading it and going, oh my God, there are bad people in the church accepted because there are bad people everywhere. But why did the Catholic Church move these men around and put more of our children in harm's way? So I was a part of the Family Christian movement and part of the small Christian communities. And I wrote to the Archbishop at Hartford, Cronin, who had been at Fall River, and said, you need to tell me. I got to find it in my heart to forgive these bad people. They're sick. They're on their own journey. But you got to tell me why the Catholic Church hasn't admitted its guilt in moving these men around and putting more children in harm's way. And I, in essence, got an FU letter back from the guy with legalese language in it. And I left the Catholic Church.
And so there's a lot of awakening moments happening right in this time of your life, it sounds like. And you're in this crux of your own physical pain. By reading all those different pieces, you know, what's the takeaway? What was the aha? Because are you talking about like an insight into a state of mindfulness or the power of it to heal the body? Like what was the thing that you found in that excavation of knowledge?
A, there is no good or bad. It's a karmic journey. You know, the people that do bad things are on their own karmic journey. We're all on this karmic journey together. And so there is no good or bad. There just is. There are consequences. And that all of us work through those consequences in any number of lifetimes. And I've accused myself of actually screwing up every lifetime so I can live again because I like living. But anyway, I'll know I'm on my last life when I come back as a German shepherd in a very nice family that loves me to death. Then I'll know I'm on my last journey. That's the gimme that you're on your way to Samadhi. And so I go through this whole thing and I'm looking. So there's no good or bad. Number one. Number two, the yamas and the niyamas are the Ten Commandments, but they were written 50,000 years ago, not 3,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. We are all the same thing. And so my mantra is soham. I am that, and that is me. It's all, we're all one. We just don't realize it yet. We've been clouded by the unfolding of the one who existed in the beginning to realize that there was no awareness unless there were others. So it unfolded upon itself and created this mass of people and things to find their way back to the one. And in that journey, that karmic journey, there's realization, awareness, and we all learn how to be better people and to be part of it. And so it's, and so it was like this whole awakening to me that said, you know, being an asshole is not a good thing. Being a tough guy is not a good thing. Fair, honest, respectful. And so I was like stunned.
I've read the book Siddhartha many, many, many times, the Hermann Hesse book. And in the final chapters, or in the final paragraph even, there's that description of a moment where Siddhartha, this person who's on a journey of enlightenment, all of a sudden is asked by one of his former best friends who kind of disappeared for a while and came back, to explain his wisdoms. And his one wisdom was that pretty much exactly what you just described, that there is not a good or a bad, that it's all there. And that it's all happening all at once. In fact, that there's no sequence of time, that it's all at once. And that we are within that. And maybe, you know, maybe that's the sound of Om, or maybe that's the sound, you know, in these different philosophies. But you're reading all this and you have this as a context, in the context of extreme physical pain, not spiritual pain, but physical pain. I mean, you once told me in a former conversation that it got to the point where you were ready to die. You had like made plans to leave.
I had made arrangements, yep. Dead my life, yep.
Because the pain was so brutal. So how does this philosophical enlightenment then go on to change this physical blockage?
So, you know, the notion that there is no time and everything that's ever happened and will happen is all happening now. And it's our limited organic capabilities to comprehend it. So we need ways of marking that journey. It's part of the duality, right? Finding our way back from the duality to the singularity. And my son's a physicist as well. And so, you know, his comment to me was, you know, Dad, there is no time in physics. It doesn't exist. And yeah, everything is happening now that ever happened. And that your electrons can be anywhere in the universe at any given moment. You just don't know where they are. They're going to be somewhere. So you're part of everything and everything is you. And so I was talking with him. We ride motorcycles together. And so we're sitting at a diner talking about this. I'm talking about it from the standpoint of the Bhagavad Gita. He's talking about it from the standpoint of physics. And this father, we grab our helmets. We're headed out. And this father grabs my hand as I walk by. He goes, he's got a four-year-old saying with him, is this what I have to look forward to? I said, only if you're lucky. Spend time with your son. Talk to him. Talk to him now about things that maybe he doesn't understand, but will be a dialogue going forward. Because that connection is the connection we should have with everyone. The love of our sons and our families should be one we have with everyone, regardless of what they look like or who they are or who they love or how they love. It doesn't matter. And so it gave me solace that I had a practice I could turn to. And every morning I would either go to the gym and work out or I would go to the mat and do my spiritual work. And it allowed me to get rid of the anxiety before I walked into work so that I was present and available for everybody versus being working on my own crap and dealing with my own stuff. And that community that connected around it, because people always thought I was distant. So finally, one day I sat down with my team. I said, let me tell you what, Mark, let me give you the user manual here. I'm in constant pain all the time. I sleep 1 hour a night. Half the night I'm screaming in pain in my room by myself. My wife doesn't even sleep with me. She sleeps in another room. I'm up all night and in such pain. So the fact that I'm here and sitting in front of you and we're able to converse and talk about important things and help people is a credit to my belief system and my belief in all of you as part of that belief system.
So I when you're talking about this, I also have this kind of other thought that's starting to tingle in my mind. There was two times now that you've described where you went into hyper focus. The first one with your son. It's like, okay, one part of your brain turns off, the other part of your brain turns on, and you go, and you're going to make this thing happen, and you do. The second time is when you're in so much pain that you're getting 1 hour of sleep, and it's bad sleep because you're in pain. And this is going on for 18 years. So we're talking about extreme, persistent sleep deprivation, and yet you're able to function in a way that takes Aetna at the time from being something to being something much bigger. You're able to grow the company as its CEO into something that became a global force. So your brain then obviously has done something very, very, very hard to do in terms of organizing and running a company of that scale. But in a state of distress, do you think that, I mean, is there a lesson there that, like, is it that in order to be super highly functioning, we actually need to be almost in a state of fight or flight or some kind of, you know, like what's going
all
on?
All pain's in the brain. All pain is in the brain. It's not in your body. It's in your brain. And in the pain center of your brain. And if you can exercise control over that, you don't make it go away, but you pay less attention to it. And part of my paying less attention to it, when I had my injury, I had a psychologist come and see me. And he said, Mark, you have to get back to work as soon as you can. 80% of the people that never work after an injury like yours, my exact injury, end up killing themselves. So you need to get back in the world. You need to reengage. You need to find something important to do so that you can give of yourself. And through the endorphin release of that and the focus that you have to be able to do it, you can at least manage it.
So is that what happened? Is that
going to go away?
So do you live in pain now, or have you been released from the pain?
No, so on February 15th, 2023, I had made arrangements to go to Switzerland to be evaluated for a final 2 or 3 month visit with Dignitas, to go through the final plans to kill myself. So I was going to go to Switzerland to do assisted suicide.
What? When was this? Recently?
February 15th, 2023.
Wow.
A year in front of that, or more than a year in front of that, I had to prove one thing, and that was that I had intractable pain, that my pain was incurable.
And it got to that point.
I had my paperwork all filled out. I had joined the organization. I understood the process, started bringing my wife through it, all that sort of stuff. And I had to go see a doctor. And so I go see this doctor, Dr. Schubner at University of Michigan. And he sits and we talk. And he looks at me and he goes, Mark, you don't have intractable pain. I can't give you that diagnosis. You have neuroplastic pain. And we can fix it.
The word
neuroplastic. Do you know how many times I've heard people say they can fix me? Do you know how much I've had 9 major surgeries? I've done 25 milligrams of ketamine an hour for a week in a hospital ICU to try and reboot my system. I've done everything. People tapping on my back, people, you know, rubbing my head. I mean, I've done every possible thing and none of it ever worked. Wow. Why are you telling me this now? I don't believe you.
Ketamine's a horse tranquilizer. That's also known as a dissociative, right? It's supposed to try to, in a lot of ways, be the thing that allows you to be neuroplastic. And that didn't work?
Yeah, and it did. I mean, well, first of all, so... after 2 days of 25 milligrams an hour of ketamine, IV, I'm strapped to a hospital bed. All of a sudden, the IV poles, I had three of them on me, started talking to me. And I called the nurse in and I said to the nurse, these things keep telling me to get a colonoscopy, because that was the sound they sounded like they were making. She goes, oh, okay, we're a little high. She comes back in with Vistarol, knocks me down a bit, and I go to sleep, right? I wake up the next morning, and I am like stone cold sober. My body has adjusted to the 25 milligrams an hour of ketamine.
I never got addicted to drugs.
I could use them. I never got addicted to them. So I don't, my system, my biology doesn't allow me to be addicted to these drugs. And so all of a sudden my color, my palette and my color, my vision was bad. It was still crazy. Everything was in pastel. But I couldn't get higher anymore.
A little bit more context for those who might be listening who don't understand what we're talking about in terms of this specific drug. It's a horse tranquilizer, like I said earlier, but it's a deeply hallucinogenic drug at that dose, right? I mean, you're talking about something where, you know, where it's been referred to as a K-hole for people that use this in the, you know, illicitly in a party situation, something like this, right? Like it takes people to these other alternate dimensions, and you're doing this in a hospital setting, strapped to a bed, and they're taking you there. What's your memory of what you saw there?
It was all trippy. I mean, it was all very trippy. You know, things coming when you didn't know what was real after a while. Everything was pastel colored, some, you know, washed out version of its real color. And they had a little TV in there. I had no pain. I had no pain. Now, in Germany, they do 50 milligrams an hour and they put you in a coma for a week, but they're not allowed to do that in the United States. This was at Hahnemann Hospital in Philadelphia. I had this treatment done. Dr. Schwartz, not Schwarzkopf, Schwartzman did it. And so after a week, you know, even though I sobered up, it still had some effect. I was actually watching TV and The Wizard of Oz was coming on, and I had my iPod. They let me keep my iPod. They wouldn't let me keep a phone. And so I take the iPod, and you know, if you start the Dark Side of the Moon album at the second roar of the MGM line, it tracks the movie. So I'm doing that, right? And the nurse comes in, because I figured if I'm high, I might as well enjoy it, right? And so the nurse comes walking and she goes, do you want me to turn off the TV? I go, no, I'm watching it. She goes, but you got your earplugs in, you're listening to your iPod. Yeah, I go, I'm listening to Dark Side of the Moon. It tracks the movie. She leaves the room, comes back in, and knocks me out with Vistarol. She thought I was high again.
Oh, yeah. So it's colonoscopies and The Wizard of Oz that knock you out. That's awful. So she took you away from it.
So I had no pain for 2 months. And then it started coming back, and it was worse.
So the kind of pain you're talking about, when you're saying that it's neuroplastic, Is it the feeling of nerve pain, which often is like a burning and tingling sort of thing, or a striking
burning,
pain?
Burning, tingling, sharp shooting pains. Yeah, all that stuff.
Okay, so this is sounding very familiar to me, because this is what I had, right? But it was in the phantom part. It was in the part of my body that didn't exist. It was, they had chopped off my leg. My brain had some wires that were screaming out loud. And in the air, I had that feeling of burning, sharp, stabbing pain. And they said, okay, well, let's see what we can do. And, you know, like, what do you do? How do you treat that? If you can't give it, you can't give it some opioid, because it's not a physical thing. It's a brain thing.
Yeah, it's a brain thing. And I actually argued with the doctors after a couple of years. It's cut my arm off. And they have these things called the bionic arms. You know, they now can reconnect them. They can play piano. They can do all sorts of things with them. And the doctor said to me, Mark, right now you can rub your left hand to try and dampen the pain when you have a pain outbreak, because that's biofeedback. When I cut it off, you can't do that anymore.
Oh, so you were talking about chopping off your arm to let go of the pain that was in your arm. And he's like, well, this is your one little receptor back. Wow.
So they kept me, so it came roaring back. And so they said, why don't you come in on the first Friday of every month and we'll give you 25 milligrams for 4 hours and give you a booster. And so I'm sitting in the place where they give drugs, you know, the IV room, and I'm sitting in a recliner and I'm watching TV with a bunch of people getting any sort of chemotherapy, all sorts of other stuff. And I'm getting my ketamine and I'm watching Rachel Ray making a flaming mushroom ragu. And I'm listening to the Talking Heads Stop Making Sense album. And just as she lights it, Burning Down the House comes on and I start laughing and I'm hysterical. Nurse comes over, has to give me a sedative.
She knocks you out again.
I was laughing so hard. No, she didn't knock me out. She just slowed me down a bit. Laughing so hard. I said, I can't keep doing this. By then, I'm CEO of the company. I said, I can't keep doing this. This is crazy. I can't do this anymore. So I moved on to a bunch of different therapies. But in the end, I found these people in California. There's a book called The Way Out by Alan Gordon. And Dr. Schubner gave me that book and I read it and I called Alan and I started treatment and 9 months later I was pretty much pain free.
Wait, you just brushed over this last part. So what's the treatment? What is it?
So first of it's cognitive behavioral therapy. So sort of disconnecting some of the beliefs you had, because like I used to shave the left side of my face. So I wouldn't shave because it felt like I was shaving my arm and it hurt. Because the brain doesn't let brain cells be inactive. They get connected to the next thing. And the part of my brain that was injured with the arm happens to sit right next to the brain cells for my face. So I said, well, it's connected. And they said, okay, well, let's try. We did a few exercises. So you go through a whole bunch of cognitive behavioral therapy, reframing the pain. But you need physical treatment. So I got TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. And they fired it at the specific part of at the 42 pain centers in my brain, disconnecting them. Because what they said is after 18 years of chronic pain, all of those things wire together so that anything feels like pain.
Okay. So on one level, you've got a story that you're rewriting. And on another level, you're trying to throw your old stories into the air with this transcranial magnetic therapy.
Stimulation.
Yeah. Is this where they put electrodes on your brain and they stimulate it with like low voltage or what is it?
No, it's like a big ping pong paddle, a thick ping pong, and they put it on your head and they aim a beam of magnetism at the part they're trying to affect.
Now, this is pretty wild because there's so many parallels to my experience with phantom limb pain. And just to reiterate for those that might not be versed in this and are coming to it for the first time, the brain has a map of reality, and that map is just these well-trodden pathways that have been fired enough times where it becomes like kind of like your reality. It becomes what they call your default mode, right? And so then what you're describing here are that there's these certain therapies, one being transcranial magnetic, what is it called?
Stimulation.
Yeah, stimulation to try to induce a state of neuroplasticity where all those signals, those well-trodden signals get sort of freed up in a state. Is that right? Okay, so then you've got a story where you're like, okay, change the story. Don't shave this thing anymore. Don't do this thing. Don't feel the pain associated with this. And at the same time, free your brain of the hold to it, to its previous map. Is that right?
And then immediately after the TMS, that was half an hour of TMS, they put me in a virtual reality room with a whole headset. And they started doing limb reintegration therapy. So I would be sitting in a chair in a glen with mountains in the background, and there would be little gleaming things in the grass. And I'd stare at them, and they would grow a tree. And the tree would grow seed pods, and I'd stare at the seed pods, and they would fall to the ground and create little gleaming things. So like in half an hour, I could build a whole forest around me. And at the end of it, you could hear this mastodon coming. Boom, boom, boom. You didn't know what it was in the beginning. And then it comes and puts your trunk on your lap, and I petted it with my left hand in virtual reality.
This is in a hospital? You're petting mastodon?
Yep.
This is an epic hospital. Which hospital is this?
This is Mount Sinai East on the Upper East Side of New York City, of Manhattan.
You're petting mastodons. You're petting yep. virtual mastodons.
Or I was washing my hands at a sink for half an hour. Or I was making clay pots, dishes, and cups. Or I was walking through a forest.
Wow. And after this process, and you continue to cycle this process, eventually
pain goes away. Yeah, because you're reorienting, you're rebuilding new pathways. And the trips were meant to give you a psilocybin-like trip with the way they were, the construction of these virtual reality things were like you were on psilocybin. I mean, how often does a mastodon walk up to you and, you know, lay a trunk on your lap?
This is last year. This is what happened in the last year.
It started in March, April of 2002. And I did it until June of 23. Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, you talk about psilocybin, right? And we just launched the Center for Psychedelic Research at UC San Diego. And the first clinical trial was using psilocybin in heavy doses and to treat phantom limb pain based off of my own experience, the case study of my own experience. And the results are pretty incredible and is achieving the same idea that you can put the brain into a state of neuroplasticity. And then in that time, you can rewire things so that there's some kind of release of trauma or a release of some kind of blockage in the mind's ability to get back to harmony. And now you're just saying that you're able to do this in a methodical way in VR glasses? The VR glasses helmet. Creating the same state
of mind? It's a whole helmet. It's headphone, ear, headset, glasses, the whole thing. It goes over your head like a space
helmet. So you got something acting on the brain, creating a magnetic force that's allowing your brain to be free, and then you've got this helmet on your head at the same, or
no, right, it goes on after, immediately after, yeah.
And then you're in Mastodon land. You're in the Wizard of Oz.
And then I did digital mirror therapy to get my dexterity. Oh, we had a
really similar. You had to do mirror therapy.
Yeah, but digital. They now have a digital mirror therapy. What they do is you do everything with your right hand, for me, with my right hand, do all the little exercises, they record it, and then they flip it with the computer, and you put your hand under the screen, and it's amazing how much your hand can do when you think it's actually your hand moving.
So, you know, mirror therapy for me was fundamental, and I got to work with V.S. Ramachandran, the guy who discovered mirror therapy. Where he placed a mirror between my legs and I could see two limbs again and all, you know, let the pain go away. And the way I always describe it to people is that the mirror is the story and the neuroplasticity, it was for me, the psilocybin, a heavy dose of psilocybin that allowed me to do this. But it could also be, you know, in any other context, a very similar thing where, like, for example, in the gospel church, you got the preacher who's giving the story, but before you get everybody into this state of, you know, euphoria. You do the singing. You go wild. You get into the mantra and you get your brain into that altered state of consciousness. Or, you know, like anything, any kind of major ceremony that I've seen in cultures around the world feels like it's trying to achieve the same thing where you get your brain into a place where you can free it of its holds and then you send it a message. And that we've designed so many cultural systems like that to try to embed knowledge or try to embed a perspective into people's minds. It could also be used for the negative. It could be used for mind, you know, brainwashing. It could be used for all sorts of things. But if it's used, you know, in a way that's intentional for healing, it seems like for you and I both, it's saved our lives.
And I still do cognitive behavioral therapy because as I started getting through the pain, I realized there was a lot of other work to do. So I was abused as a child and you know, I had all this. Part of my superpower is I'm really good at threat assessment. I have a very highly tuned threat assessment mechanism in my brain. The bad part is that I'm always assessing threats. And when you assess threats, you elevate your heart rate and everything else in the reptilian brain to a point where it's not too far away from expressing itself. And so I had to learn how to stop the threat assessment. And part of it was, and I do this exercise almost every day now, is I sit with my hands on my feet on the floor, my hands on my legs. And when I get anxious, it's really about anxiety. Anxiety is the fear of uncertainty. And when you're in chronic pain, the fear that it'll never go away is real. And so you get this assessment that, you know, I can't do anything. I'm screwed, right? And it's going to kill me, right? When my pain first showed up in 2004, I thought I'll never live 10 years with it. Here it is, 20 years now.
Yeah, you almost died. Like you almost literally killed. You almost went to assisted suicide. So you got to that point, and then you got out through the other end of it. But then you still have that built up trauma, the anxiety of it, right?
And the therapy I do today is around this anxiety and threat assessment. And so what I do is I imagine, I feel where the anxiety sits. And for me, it's right in the middle of my chest. And what I do is I step out in front of me and I see a door there. And I open that door and I jump in. I just head first into the anxiety and I let it overcome me. I just let it get harder and worse and more anxious. I scream, I punch pillows, I cry, I do all that sort of stuff. And at some point it crescendos. And when it crescendos, you realize I'm not dead. I can do this. And then immediately I stop, I get up and I get on my bike or I listen to music or I go for a walk with the dog. I do whatever, something that pleases me to associate this good activity with this having beaten the crescendo of anxiety. And so where I used to do it four or five times a day, I now do it once a week, maybe once a day, sometimes depending on what kind of stress levels I'm on. But it's always to remind myself, it's not going to kill me. I can control it.
And also, maybe in a way, to recognize that the subtle power, the subtle kind of nagging force of trying to resist it is something you can turn off too, right? Because resistance to something is in fact keeping it there longer. You know, I've noticed that with pain. Like when people said, how did you approach pain when it was the worst, when they were chopping your leg off, you know? And I'm like, well, it sounded to me like what you just described is what I would think about doing with pain, is that if you just fully embrace it, like lean into it, don't try to hold it and resist it or whatever, clench and try to think that you can somehow imagine it away. You just let yourself lean into that thing, and then after a while, you're like, hey, you know, it's almost more like a thought that you're observing from the outside, and it hasn't killed you, and so you can almost just like, oh, well, that's what that is, and let it sit.
In Alan Gordon's book, they call it somatic tracking. You're somatically tracking your pain. And realizing it's not here, it's here. And if you can understand it and embrace it and say, this isn't going to kill me, it's not structural anymore, it's literally driven by my brain, you can control it.
In that state of neuroplasticity, though, I've also started to wonder, is pain and memory deeply tied together?
Totally. That's my point. That's my deep work. So I have to go back. So I used to have this nightmare when I was a kid. There was this painting of the Virgin Mary with the baby Jesus in her lap and a halo over her head. And I always was staring at that and I was always frightened by it. What I realized by going through therapy to go back to early life issues and the things that triggered me was I was watching for my mother to come up those stairs because her shadow showed on that painting when she was coming up the stairs.
Mm. Wow. And you were terrified.
And when I realized that, it's threat assessment, it's anxiety, got to bring it down. And so you start going through all of these things, you empty out these things that sit in your amygdala. Because remember, trauma sits in the amygdala and it's not date stamped. My accident in my amygdala was as if it happened yesterday. I would see somebody fall on TV skiing and immediately I'd be in a horrible state of pain.
So you had strong PTSD that just by seeing the act of skiing would bring it all back physically.
Right. Yeah. And that's the amygdala. That's what the amygdala does. It Trauma sits in the amygdala undate stamped. It's there forever unless you confront it and work it out.
Okay. So then you work it out and you got rid of the pain. I mean, that's, first of all, that's incredible. Did it affect your memory? Like, have other parts? Because for me, there's huge gaps in my memory. And I've always wondered whether or not those gaps in my memory from that period have to do with the tinkering I was doing to my pain networks. Whether or not I somehow lost bits and pieces that I didn't want to lose.
There's this group in California called the Brain Treatment Center. They're in Laguna Niguel. And I went to see them early on. It was just TMS they were doing then. And I had lost some field vision because I had a subdural up here. I had lost some field vision in the lower left quadrant of my left eye. And I did TMS and it came back. They reactivated the brain cells that were somehow, you know, not their view. This is a bunch of Chinese scientists, by the way. They're brilliant. They came up with this view that the brain is an electronic instrument, and that if any of the cells in the brain are not firing at the same rate, the same millihertz as the rest of the brain, you get anxiety and pain. So what they do is they do a map. They put a thing on your head. They map your whole brain. Each cell gets a number, and they look for, they do this 3D version, and they look for the parts of your brain that are operating at a fundamentally lower level than the rest of your brain. And for me, it was up here where my injury was, my subdural. So what they did is they tuned to that depth, and they brought them back up to 11.7 millihertz, which is what the rest of my brain was running at.
Which frequency is that? What do they call that one? Like there's the alpha, beta, gamma, you know,
I think it's beta wave. But 11.7. So they got it back up, and my field vision came back over here, and my memory of the accident came back. And so I had to deal with that whole thing. I had to go through the whole thing of what happened, and, you know, and because I didn't even remember having the accident at first.
Now you remembered it in that state, in that meditative state?
I remember looking at my daughter's face, and her eyes widened. And like the last view I had of her was just her eyes, and her eyes went, gee, I was about to hit the tree.
How's your daughter doing now after all this? It must have affected her.
She just left. She was the president of the Daily Beast. She helped found Gawker Media with Nick Denton. And now she's running Dwell, the online design and home site.
Your family is very successful. You guys are very driven. You've all running all your own companies and doing your thing and teaching the kids and all this. Okay. So, you know, I know I've taken up a lot more of your time than was expected, but it's just such an interesting and paralleled story to my own understanding of nerve pain. The question of, we keep on talking about the brain, but we're also talking about the mind and the sort of differentiation of the mind and the body. Where does one end and the next one begin? And I've started to really think that maybe there's a correlation to mindfulness in that I just had this conversation with my good friend Richard Davidson. Do you know Richie by any chance?
Richie, University of Wisconsin.
Yeah,
he was on the Mind and Life Institute. I was on the Mind and Life Institute with Richie for a while.
Oh, really? Oh, with the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, the Dalai Lama's Foundation. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I, you know, and his work mapping the brain during these deep states of meditation, you know, it says that you can create these long-term traits, right? Not just momentary effects, but long-term traits. Now, you've done this over a long time. You've been doing this for 20 years now, building up one trait. Now, the last couple of years, trying to knock that trait apart and break it down again. Do you think that the shortcut that's being kind of highlighted a lot right now is as effective as the long version? What I mean is, right now, psilocybin is at a center of a cultural conversation for therapy, for neuroplasticity, for everything, for daily life, for, you know, it's been talked about left and right. But there's also what you described, you know, these kind of very, very systematic, rigorous, long-term meditation practices that you have been doing, from yoga to now what you described in this, that are essentially trying to do the same thing, but in a slightly, I don't know, maybe like a slightly more methodical way rather than a single moment. Do you have any thoughts about that?
So if in the Vinny Yoga approach to meditation, first of all, a lot of people in the United States, particularly, and probably other Western civilizations, have this view of meditation where you sit in this moment of complete darkness and serenity, and all of a sudden great ideas come to you, or moments come to you to describe it. And in the Vinny Yoga view of meditation is that, you know, understanding of the yamas and the niyamas, the physical practice of asana and the breathing practice of pranayama, all combined, motions initiated by breath and understanding, allows you to sit in meditation for an extended period of time. And it's in that extended period of time that you address the things you are attached to. So most people say, well, it's always so confusing, it's always noisy in my head. Those are attachments. So what you do is, when you're sitting there and these things come, you give them the reverence they're due. They're important to you in some way in your life. You understand why they're important, and you let them go. And you keep doing that and doing that and doing that and doing that, and eventually they don't come back. What I've not seen is the psilocybin approach, because I used them in college, and I used to use transcendental meditation and psilocybins to go to school full time, work full time, and party full time. I'm not quite sure that psilocybins address this long term attachment issue effectively. Losing attachments to people, things, and ideas really are hard to do unless you purposely work on them and get rid of them. No, there's no magic bullet for that. So if you think of attachments as triggers for anxiety, oh, I got to get the cars washed this weekend, I haven't washed them for 2 weeks, or whatever it is that people attach themselves to and do over and over and over again. I can say that I have dumped a boatload of attachments in my last 20 years, and I feel really good about them, and it's freeing. You know, I don't collect things like I used to. And it allowed me to create a heuristic in my head. I call it the mental model of how the world works, in an objective point of view, to try and understand why it works the way it does. And so that's been the beauty. And actually, psilocybin's helping that kind of thinking as well. You know, how do we attach things that otherwise don't look relevant to one another, but they are? So the one caution I would have on meditation and short-circuiting with psilocybins, I'm not quite sure it does as an effective job on attachment elimination that it probably the long-term form does.
And the long-term form is just doing the work of sitting with your thoughts. Now that's tough for a lot of people, right? Like, you think about how often you walk in the door and the first thing you do is put on some music or turn on the TV or do something so you don't have to sit in the silence of your own thoughts. And then when you actually do sit in silence with your own thoughts, it does feel overwhelming at first. But I just finished reading in super detail the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, and they describe, there's this one paragraph which describes this one guru's views on what the secret of meditation is. And he says, you know, your thoughts, they come at first like a waterfall, and you can't differentiate one thought from the other. But then you start to string them out, if you can sit with them for long enough, and you start getting them one after the other. And then you start realizing that there's actually a little gap between thoughts. And you just try to expand that gap between thoughts. And eventually that gap between thoughts, that space in between, is what you're really looking for. You just try to have the space between thoughts expand and expand and expand through acceptance and relief and release of your thoughts, of observation of your thoughts rather than emotional attachment to your thoughts. I think that was a big lesson for me. But now you have run, and in the fight, you know, I'm going to wrap this up in a little bit because I know I've taken a lot of your time, but you've run one version of healthcare, which is one that I think I had Aetna at one point. So, you know, like you were the CEO of a company that provided me the financial means to access healthcare for a long time. So thank you. But now you run another health care organization, a new one. Oscar, is that right?
Oscar Health, yep.
Yeah. So does it incorporate some of yourself, these epiphanies that you've had and how we think about healthcare in America today? Like, how are you approaching the future of healthcare? Because obviously you take your own experiences and they have impact on millions of people. You know, like your experiences with your son and your own journey, that arc occurred over a period of time that you were overseeing access to health for millions and millions and millions of people. So how do your epiphanies now in that last journey and this kind of deeper understanding of the mind and the relationship of the mind and the mind health to our physical health, what is that doing for how we're going to experience healthcare through your lens in the future?
First and foremost, we have to meet people where they are. And this is a statement I made 15 years ago that's now become sort of part of the nomenclature. Your zip code matters more than your genetic code in your health. Your community, where you live, how you live, has far more impact on your physical and mental health than your genetic code does. And yet we think that we can find the solution in the genes. And it's not. We got to find the solution in the community, how people live, work, and play together. So it starts to introduce things like, at Oscar, we have a single platform. We have one database, one version of the truth on everybody, where all the other big carriers, including Aetna, have multiple versions of the truth. And we use large language models to do most of the work digitally that companies have to pay people to do sitting at a desk in front of a phone, treated like veal in a cubicle. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to have people doing that kind of work if you can actually let people do their own work and have their own journey and find their own way. As a result, our NPS at Oscar is 66. That means 83% of the people like us and 17% don't.
Wow.
So NPS is good. How many people like you versus how many people don't. The net number is 66. The industry average is 0.
Well, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah.
But that's also really bad for the industry, that the average is 0. Nobody likes the industry of healthcare. Yeah.
So the idea is what can we do? Everything we do is focused on the member's experience and making it better for them. And this gets back to a thing that, you know, Jeff Bezos once told me a long time ago. I never disrupted any industry. I found an unmet need, met it well, and those people left the people they used to go see and they came to me. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're working on that model.
I guess what I mean though is coverage going to include mindfulness meditation coaching? Is it going to include, you know, like the insights that you have, right? Like you went through a spiritual journey of investigation. You also went through a Western medicine version of the same thing with your son and that textbook and all that other stuff, right? So the thing that I'm hearing is that there's some integrated approach of both, right? Like there some is. Kind of. And
so you got to integrate mental and physical health, because your mental condition has as much to do with your physical condition. My chronic pain, I had 9 major surgeries trying to solve my chronic pain, thinking it was structural. None of it mattered. It only made it worse.
How can a doctor say, hey, go and sit with your thoughts? You show up to a doctor's office and you're screaming in pain. You're saying, kill me, doc. I can't take this anymore. And he's like, oh, no, go sit with your thoughts. I prescribe you 100 hours of meditation. Like that, how does that work?
So what you need, what we've done at what's called Health Tracks, as a company I'm now helping fund and lead, is that we have taken the therapy that I've gone through on chronic pain, and we're now multi-purposing it for PTSD, same thing, anxiety, and we're rolling it out, and we're raising funding right now to roll it out across the country. This issue of neuroplasticity affects 1.5 billion people around the world. And it affects 65 million people here in the United States. So if we can get them thinking differently through cognitive behavioral therapy and some active things like TMS and virtual reality, and we can break the cycle. One of the most profound, there were two real big emotions that hit me when I came out of pain. Number one was, how could I have been so stupid for 18 years? My brain's a good brain. Why didn't I figure this out? And it took me a while. I mean, I was angry with myself. I was like, I spent all this money. I had all these relationships that had to suffer through my pain all the time. Oh my God, what an idiot I am. And then the second one was, I now need to learn how to embrace these emotions I haven't felt deeply for 18 years. I almost need to go on an apology tour. I felt like I was, you know, going up, you know, like Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the 12-step program. I felt I was like on step 5 or something. I got to go tell people my story and why I was such and apologize. I mean, it was
what?
It was terrible
because you were so grumpy during the pain years. Is that why?
I was less empathetic than I otherwise am normally.
Yeah, I mean that's understandable, right? You're in extreme pain. You know, you're not going to put up with a lot of bull, right?
You know what? But how many people have looked at you about your pain or said, I had one relationship. My first wife looked at me and said, I'm tired of hearing about your goddamn arm. Get a hold of yourself. Grow up. And it's like, this is not like optional shit. I'm not making this stuff up at night.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But for those who are around us, I can also understand that they want to, you know, like, they want to live their own lives, and they don't want to just be always catering towards us, thinking that our pain is the center of the universe. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right?
It's exhausting.
The idea that we might be able to provide healthcare to those in need of some kind of solution to chronic pain outside of opioids with meditation, mindfulness, these other things, these alternative medicines, and possibly psilocybin. I mean, that really is the frontier right now. And maybe it's a combination of all those things. But for me, as a scientist who's also looked through time, back into history, back into our ancient history, the use of whatever technique to get to altered states of consciousness has been at the center of our human journey. I mean, it's ritual. It's every single culture has tapped into some kind of state where they get their brain to that state of neuroplasticity as a functional tool to create culture, to create reality, to move mountains, to move societies. So the bigger question, I think, is, you know, as we face this frontier of neuroplasticity in medicine, what impact will those same tools have on how we do everything else, from learning to how we tell stories, how political entities might manipulate societies, to how we wage war, to how, everything. You know, if the tools for neuroplasticity start becoming more functional as these things that you can sort of like turn on and off and prescribe, then they can also be used for everything else in how we shift our mind's perspectives. And that's kind of scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, well, if you there's a speech that J.B. Pritzker gave at Northwestern to the graduating class, and it's on this very point you're making. That as humans, ancient humans, we survived because we were taught that anything that didn't look like us, sound like us, love like us, or live like us, we had to be suspicious of. And when you look at all the bases of hostility and war, that's the center point. They're not like us. And that a highly evolved brain is a brain that learns to overcome that initial reptilian response and not act on it and be kinder and learn and be curious and courageous. And it's that curiosity and courageousness that teaches our brains that not everything needs to look like us or be like us or love like us or live like us. And that is in the richness of the humankind, when they're all brought together, that matters. And it's good for us that that happens. But right now, in our world, particularly our political dynamic, you can become president behaving like a reptile brain. And you can use your bully cudgel to push people back and scare them. And that succeeds. And so we have all the wrong lessons in our society when this happens. So I think you're right. I think if we could evolve our brains and, you know, remember the teachings of Don Juan, right? Carlos Castaneda did his PhD thesis on this stuff and learned the biggest problem we have, do we have enough practitioners to take care of all the people we need to take care of to get them? How do we teach our schools in the very beginning, in the most formative years, K through three, on how to help kids understand this instead of letting them build these reptilian responses as attachments? They're attachments. And so one of the things we're working at Healing Track is how do we get enough coaches to be able to sit with the Mark Bertolinis of the world? We have three stages. We have computer-based training, we have group therapy with avatars, and then we have individual therapy, depending on how severe the case is. But getting enough coaches, because Carlos Castaneda went looking for the last shaman, right? And he found him in Don Juan. And he taught him more, but not in like, okay, here's your book, read this page, look at this thing, do these practices. He taught him through experience. And yeah, like I read all seven books, but the first three books were the books that mattered. And the third book was the most profound. Oh my God, I had it wrong all along. I don't know if you've ever read his books.
There's one sitting on my door right there. Yeah, I've got, I just appeared. It actually just arrived. I've been handed the books many times, and this last one was given to me in a very profound moment. So it's up next.
The first book is his PhD thesis. The next book is on further journeys. The third book is when it all comes to him, he goes, oh my God, I was looking at this all the wrong way. And it gets to your point. This has been going on for so long, but we've lost our teachers. And how do we
find them? Now we got to build them back. I mean, you know, I think it's by starting with these kinds of conversations where we start to pull back and investigate the layers of our mind and the tools that we've had through time to try to get there. Mark, I think we should probably use that as a wrap, for this one episode, but there should be more. We need to continue talking because we haven't touched so many more of the deep moments. But I want to thank you. You know, you've lived a life as an explorer of health, an explorer of the mind and the body. And you've done so while at the same time being at the head of industries. To think about somebody who has access to all of the medical world, it'd probably be you, CEO of Aetna, right? And so if you're the one who has access to all of the world of medicine and you've gone through these pretty brutal life experiences with health through it all, the story that I've heard in the last hour has been that the answers don't lie in the textbooks. They lie in the frontier. Of course, there is incredible results in the textbooks as well. And there is a very big role for Western medicine and an important one. But there's still an entire frontier out there, and it might be hidden in deeper wisdoms of the past. That's pretty exciting. So let's go do some expeditions.
Yeah, and there's a lot more to talk about at some point. But my brother John, who's 11 months behind me, I'm the oldest, he had a massive heart attack. He knew he was having it. And he was a very athletic guy. He rode his bike to the gym, worked out for an hour, half, rode his bike back, and all of a sudden had a huge chest pain. His wife puts him in the car because they can't get an ambulance. This is in Houston. Drives him over to Houston Methodist Cardiac Center. He cardiac arrests after he runs into the ER and drops on the bench. And they resuscitate him four times that afternoon. He had a widowmaker blockage in his heart. And the first thing he said to me when he woke up, because I flew down to Houston, I ran the midnight shift because I was working during the day, but I was with him the whole time telling him what a jerk he was his whole life. And while I was in a coma, he was in a medically induced coma. And he wakes up and he looks at me and he goes, "You have always taken care of me. That has made a big difference today." It's us, right?
maybe that is the biggest lesson of all, is that we just need to take good care. We just need to care for each other, right? Yeah, we just need to care for each other.
Well, thank you for having me on, Albert. I mean, it's been my distinct pleasure to get to know you. We're kindred spirits on the same journey. And it's amazing to be part of your circle and to have you as part of my community. Thank you.
I'm grateful to you, Mark. I'm grateful too. So let's schedule another one. Maybe we can find a way where we're not having to go through major life traumas to find our insights in the future. Let's try to see if there's other insights that can come from much nicer, more less physically demanding experiences. But yeah. Now, thank you for everything and all your exploration of the frontier, and for your integrating that into the mainstream of our public health. So I will end there, and we'll see you on the next one.
Hope to see you soon.
Thanks,
Mark. Take care, Albert.